Committee on Veterans and Emergency Preparedness of the Oregon State Senate will come into order for its first meeting. I want to kind of go down the agenda real quick so everybody knows what's going on, and then I'm going to do brief introductions. If you look at the agenda today, we're going to start out with introductions, which is only going to be one because I think all the committee members already know each other. And I think the public knows all of us because no one has changed, courtesy of the presiding officer to my right. Then we're going to adopt committee rules in an abbreviated form. They're the same committee rules we've done previously. And then we're going to have a series of public hearings. How the process normally works in this committee is we hear a bill in 1 week, and then if there's a work session, it'll be scheduled for the next week. For the members of the public that are out there, we have a new system. If you go to the Oregon Legislature in either Google or Yahoo, Oregon Legislature will come up, and there's a new committee tracking system called OLIS. It's on the far right-hand side, Oregon Legislative Information System. And in there, you can actually track the agendas. I believe most of the agendas for at least the next 8 weeks for this committee are posted up there. If you're going to submit testimony in advance, which is always preferable, can be sent to the committee chair, anything to committee chair or committee staff. If it comes to any of us, we consider it public testimony, public records. It'll then be posted onto the OLIS system. Couple of notes that for the future, I would encourage you to look at the staff measure summaries that are up for all of our bills too, because we do towards the end of the session have four or five bills that are placeholder bills, which are for topics that come up with the various agencies and issues we deal with. So some people look at those and suddenly think we're trying to, you know, shoot the moon out of the sky, or we're going to eliminate this agency or that. We're really not. We just have a placeholder bill there to utilize. I will say later on when we go to public hearings, we're going to go down through the list in order, except that SR 45 and SB 125 are pretty much the same bills. As way of introduction, I do want to introduce Carla Mickelson, who is to our right and the audience's left, and she is new to our committee. And you want to tell us a little bit about yourself, Carla?
Well, I'm new to the legislature, totally. I spent 18 years working for Marion Pope Legal Aid Service.
Oh, thank you very much. Normally, we begin with a tribute to veterans. As we start out, before we go forward, I would like all of the veterans in the room to stand so we can honor you.
Brian?
Yeah, I'll stand, too.
There you go, Mike. Oh, yeah, you got to stand.
Okay, with that, colleagues, we're going to move into the adoption of the committee rules. They are the same rules that we have. I could actually have the committee administrator go through the rules. They're the same rules you've already adopted elsewhere, or we could move on in efficiency, Madam Vice Chair.
Chair Boquist, I move to adopt the proposed committee rules dated today, February 7th, 2013.
Madam Vice Chair, Senator Montes Anderson moves to adopt the proposed committee rules today. Is there discussion, Senator Courtney?
There is none.
Senator Olson?
None.
Madam Vice Chair? If not, I don't think we need to vote. Is there any opposition? If there is seen none, the motion passes. The rules are adopted. With that, we're going to go right down the roster that we have. I'm going to open a public hearing. Oh, you do have. We are there. Efficiency there. I stand corrected. Madam Vice Chair?
Thank you. As you know, I'm the only woman on this committee. Thank goodness for the administrator and the committee assistant. But women are getting a lot of attention, those women who are in the military. And I would like to start each Veterans Committee meeting with some basically little snippets that women in the military have written. It's very hard for me who grew up in the 50s and 60s and to relate sometimes to how our culture has changed with regards to women and women in the military. And I think we just have to condition ourselves that we are changing, and the role of women in many different professions is changing, and so I'm just sharing. This happens to be from Master Gunnery Sergeant Constant Hines in the U.S. Marines. Oh, God, when I joined boot camp, women were just being allowed to use rifles. We were still just running a mile and a half, and the guys were running 3 miles. I would talk to women who joined the Marine Corps the year prior, and they were still doing this little etiquette thing with their gloves out in town. There were a number of times early on when commanders were like, I'm not taking you, you're a woman. I have nothing but male Marines. I don't have facilities for you. I can remember going to Honduras, 2,200 Marines, and I was the only female. Everyone wanted to tiptoe around me. You don't need to tiptoe around me, I'd say. I can use a bush just like you can use a bush. And if you're not going to take shower, then I don't need to take a shower either. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Madam Vice Chair. With those inspiring remarks, we're going to open a public hearing on SB1. Would you tee us up, Madam Counsel, and then Senator Courtney, if you would be kind enough to change places?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1 directs employers to provide notice and day off on Veterans Day or an alternative day to employees who are veterans if certain conditions are met. Permits noncompliance for disruption or hardship, declares emergency effective on passage. There is no subsequent referral.
Thank you, Madam Counsel. And for the public's awareness, we have passed this exact same bill out of this committee once before, and it went across the floor of the Senate once before. So second time's a charm. And with that, Senator Courtney, if you would, please. Senator Olson.
Oh, thank you. My name is Peter Courtney, and I live here in Salem. And I'm a state senator and representing District 11. And I introduced this bill, Senate Bill 1, and you are correct, Mr. Chair. I introduced it last session. We worked hard on it as a committee, and we amended the original version, and that is the version I introduced this time. What it does is simply say that veterans should have the opportunity to have Veterans Day off, because I learned in a conversation with a person I know, there's this little 76 gas station out here on Broadway, and I go there to get my foo-foo coffee for 99 cents and also get my car gas. And I remember the day, and she testified here last time, and I didn't have the heart to ask her to testify this time because I broke her heart when the bill did not pass last time. Her former husband, who had been a veteran of the Vietnam War, who had passed away from wounds and from that war, as well as her present husband, who was a veteran, had never been able to have Veterans Day off because of the jobs they had. And so I find it simply seemed to be rather a major contradiction. Here we have this major day for veterans, yet veterans were not necessarily getting the opportunity to have the day off. And so she told her story, and so I said, well, and she asked me why don't veterans get Veterans Day off? And I looked at her and I said, I have no idea. Don't they get Veterans Day off? And then she told me a story, and sure enough, I investigated and found out there is nothing in the law that says a veteran should be allowed necessarily a Veterans Day off. One other state has gone this route, 2010, as you know, and that's the state of Iowa. And basically, the bill simply seeks to give veterans a holiday on Veterans Day who want the day off and would be required to make a request in advance and provide the documentation before their veteran status. So they would be, in terms of if they were in a business situation or they worked in a fire department in the public sector, where their jobs might require them more or less to work that day, to go to their employer and give evidence they're a veteran and request the day off. Now, we went even further than that. I remember the gentleman sitting to my right, Senator Olson, worked very hard with the business community to amend the bill to even go further to allow this bill not to be a burden on those critically important services people, as well as that is police and fire and that, as well as the business sector. So the bill, the way it is now before you, allows employers to decide whether the day off is paid or unpaid. Furthermore, it allows employers to deny the request, although if the employee and veteran's absence will cause a significant economic or operational disruption to the business. Most importantly, it allows flexibility. If Veterans Day isn't convenient for the employer, he or she can offer a veteran a different day off. So that was the breakthrough that also broke through in Iowa as well as here, that we'd say, okay, if the business really needed this individual or if the emergency services program really needed this man or woman, that they could say, no, I can't give the day off. We really need you. How about this day? So that is the dynamic that's in this bill. Giving our nation's servicemen and women their day off is a special way of saying thank you. Our veterans risk their own lives and limbs to protect our way of life. To honor their special service in this way is the least we can do. Basically, I'm saying let's give Veterans Day their day, their special day. And so, again, you're right. It did pass out of this committee unanimously. It passed the Senate unanimously. I'm not going to get into what happened in the House. It was one of the most, it really broke my heart what happened in the House. So we're going to do it again, I hope. So, you know, it will up to you in the committee. And if it gets to the Senate floor, we're going to try it again, because I really think this state, with your leadership, the leadership of this committee, is very sensitive about veterans and veterans' issues, and really wanting to say, you can't just say you support veterans. We have to follow up with actions. And I think we've done a lot of that, Democrats and Republicans, in a very nonpartisan way, since the 9/11, more than ever, in terms of things that we have passed in this legislative body. And this is simply another way of saying, we say we support veterans, and we mean it. But we also worked hard with the different sectors of our society to say we realize that some of these people are so important, and that's a compliment. You just know you can't let them go that day, but could you let them go another day? Thank you, Chair Boquist and members of the committee, and I'm available for questions, comments, or criticisms.
Thank you, Mr. President. Senator Olson, if you would, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Madam Vice Chair, my name is Alan Olson. I'm Senator representing Senate District 20. I remember 2 years ago, it was very vivid in my mind that I talked to the President of the Senate, and he asked me what committees I'd like to be on, and I said I'd like to be on Senate Veterans Affairs. And he asked me, he said, well, I've got a bill that will allow veterans to have Veterans Day off. Would you sign on to that? And my comment was rather terse and short and said, well, if I'd like to read it first. I read it. We, as the President mentioned, we did some work on it. One of the things that came forward last session after we passed it out of the Senate was that it was a mandate to employers. And I'd like to make that very clear. The only mandate isn't to the employee, to the veteran. He must bring forward his documentation that he is a military veteran. After that, the employer has all the rights to allow or disallow. This is an exceptional bill. It does something for veterans that hasn't been done. It allows them to have their day, Veterans Day, off. Thank you.
Madam Vice Chair, questions, since there's only two of us here.
Just, you know, there was a concern about business, and I think that the way the bill is crafted, there shouldn't be opposition from the business community. And as you know, we didn't have the business community or stakeholders testifying last time. I don't know if they're going to testify this time. But to me, I think this is reasonable.
Mr. Chair, I'd also like to thank the President for the opportunity to be a co-sponsor of this bill again.
Thank you, Senator Olson. I'm sure there's some bills he has that you wouldn't want to do that on, but
thank you, Mr. President.
Okay.
Mr. Willis, Mr. Thornhill, if you would, please.
I know the two of you can agree on something, so one of you lead.
Does that mean I have to go first?
That's right.
Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Robert Thornhill. I live in Beaverton. I appear before you in support of SB 1. In doing so, I represent members of District 3 of the Oregon Veterans of Foreign Wars and its 5 Portland VFW posts. I'm honored to be accompanied by the commander of VFW Post 1442, behind me, Marion Ellsworth. He thinks I require close supervision. Since shortly after the signing of the First World War ended at the 11th hour, on the 11th day of the 11th month of 1918, America has set aside a day each year to honor the men and women who serve in uniform for the nation's common good. The first such day, Armistice Day, 11 November 1919, honored the veterans of World War I. In June 1944, following WW2, the bloodiest war of all time, followed then by Korea, Armistice Day became Veterans Day. a national holiday in which communities across this land celebrate and honor veterans of all wars for their sacrifices and achievements for the common good. Veterans Day is a paid holiday for the over 2 million federal employees, of whom 26.3%, or 542,641, of the last, according to the last available report, are veterans. Veterans Day is also a paid holiday for Oregon State employees. While we know the number of veterans employed by the federal government, as far as I know, there's no available report. We don't have the slightest idea of how many veterans are employed by the state of Oregon. One reservation on District 3's otherwise unqualified support of SB 1 is, while in our view the requirements of SB 1 have been masterfully drafted to be, in essence, voluntary on both the employer and the veteran. If in the course of these hearings strong evidence appears which indicates that the bill would inhibit employers from employing veterans, we would counsel withdrawing or amending the bill until that inhibition is overcome. To us in District 3, the dignity and the self-confidence of a good civilian job for the veteran coming home is of the highest priority. I've been asked, including, to acknowledge that we know it is the private sector employers and employees who create the wealth to pay the bills for our wars and for the benefits provided veterans, to include the cost of this bill. With the private sector, it wouldn't be possible. But we're now a part of the private sector. Senator Courtney, on behalf of my VFW comrades, thank you for sponsoring this bill. Committee, thank you for hearing me out. And all of you, on behalf of my veterans of foreign wars comrades, thank you for what you do here in Salem.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Willis, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jim Willis, and I am the director of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. I'm here today to support Senate Bill 1, which would require private employers to offer veterans of the armed forces paid or unpaid time off for Veterans Day, a day for whom Veterans Day was established. Veterans Day was established as a federal paid holiday to honor the service and sacrifice of our military veterans. The concept of all veterans getting the holiday off has long been popular with the men and women who served in uniform. Veterans and non-veterans alike who work for institutions such as banks and public entities have the day off with pay. Yet veterans who work for private businesses typically do not have that option. I believe this bill was thoughtfully proposed, as it does not intend to cause harm to private business and its operations. Employers who are unable to extend the option to their veteran employees to take November 11th off without loss of production would not be required to do so. The passage of this bill and the implementation by private employers would simply be a meaningful show of support and honor for Oregon's military veterans. Thank you for your consideration. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Madam Vice Chair?
No.
Senator Cornyn?
Senator Olson?
Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Seeing that there is no one else signed up to testify, before I close the public hearing, SB 1 is on scheduled for a work session 1 week from the day. If there's members of the public that would still like to submit testimony, please send it to the committee, and it will be considered during that work session 1 week from the day. With that, the public hearing on SB 1 is closed, and a public hearing on SJM 1 is open. Madam Counsel and Senator Monsanto, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Joint Memorial 1 urges Congress to develop a means to disclose military convictions for crimes requiring registration as a sex offender. It has a subsequent referral to the Judiciary Committee.
Thank you. Madam Vice Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm State Senator Lori Monas Anderson. I represent District 25, which is Gresham, Troutdale, Wood Village, and Fairview. And I'm bringing SJM 1. I call it the Military Sexual Assault Bill. It's a very sensitive subject and a topic that many people don't want to talk about. My first exposure to this was when I served on the governor's task force, for women's veterans, addressing women's veterans issues, actually women, military women issues. And then I met a woman, a veteran, who had a very terrible experience with sexual assault in the military. So basically what SJM won, it urges Congress to develop mechanisms that provide adequate notice to the states, to us, in which persons convicted in military courts of sex crimes plan to reside. Some individuals have said that this memorial isn't strong enough. It really needs to be stronger. And I certainly am willing to change it, but I figure this is a good first step. Sexual assault against military service members, despite pledges of zero tolerance from the Pentagon brass, remains an epidemic within the ranks. There is a gaping hole in the military sex crime protocol. The military doesn't keep a registry of convicted sex offenders, meaning that guilty parties often continue their service, even discharged into civilian life, with little to no public record of their crimes. Any individual who was involved in a rape case would not be registered as a sex offender in any national military database, meaning other women or men would have no means of knowing whether a fellow comrade had a dangerous track record. And even once that man or woman left the Marines or the Army or Air Force, there's no guarantee that he or she would show up on state-run sex offender registries. In other words, individuals who commit assault, rape, or other sexual offenses during enlistment might be able to wipe their slate clean upon return to civilian life. Data released last summer in July revealed that there was an estimated 20,000 violent sexual offenses that occurred within the ranks last year, an increase in offenses from 2010. And it is marking a terrible trend. Sexual offenses have actually increased every year since 2006, according to Pentagon estimates. And these are estimates. Military officials admit that fewer than one-third of such offenses are ever officially reported, and fewer than 500 cases per year tend to go to trial. And of those, according to the Service Women's Action Network, fewer than half lead to convictions, and a full third of convicted offenders remain in the service. So there's very few convictions, but thousands of sex offenders, they continue their military career without interruption. But even when a service member is convicted by court-martial, their offense remains dangerously difficult to detect. Until this year, in fact, the military actually disposed of any sex crimes that happened prior to 5 years. So within 5 years, if there was 5 years, then they just got rid of those records. And it made it extremely difficult to track repeat offenders, or for assaulted, raped, and victimized women or men to obtain health benefits if they waited too long to report their crimes. Many of those who have been sexually assaulted many times do not come forward until years later after it had happened. So there's been many pleas. There have been several congressional legislation proposals. The military still doesn't have its own dedicated registry of enlisted sex offenders. And that would be a good thing to have, but we aren't asking specifically for that, but I know the Service Women's Action Network is. To be clear, official military policy mandates, now this is official military policy, it does mandate that sex offenders, at least the tiny percentage of soldiers who are convicted, register within their state of residence. But in reality, The situation is really murky. Soldiers are not required to disclose their sex crime convictions on discharge papers. I support having a registry, but this legislation does not require that. There really needs to be a revamp of the military sex registry policy, but this registry is only really a small part of what needs to be done. There needs to really be a host of changes, including new procedures for handling complaints and the introduction of special units and mandated to handle such complaints in each service branch. So I know this is a topic that many of us don't talk about. It's not pleasant. It makes us uncomfortable. But I know women who have come back to civilian life with scars resulting from sexual assault in the military, and I believe that this will send a message to Congress that says we really do need to change what is happening with sexual assault in the military. And that is it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Vice Chair. Senator Courtney, questions?
Senator Olson?
No questions? It's the intent of the committee chair to move this bill. It has a subsequent referral to judiciary, it says here. So next week at this time, our intent is to move it to judiciary unless the subsequent referral is removed. And in that case, we'd vote it for the floor. But that's the plan at this point. Is there anyone else would like to testify on SJM 1? Thank you. And counsel, if you would check with both presiding officer's office and the chairman's staff of judiciary to ensure that we do want to send this to judiciary, whether we want to send it to the floor. With that, the public hearing on SJM 1 is closed, and I would again tell the public that the policy of the committee is to hear a public hearing in 1 week and then move a bill in the following week. That allows for any member of the public to submit testimony on any bill during that interim period. With that, I'm going to open a public hearing on two bills simultaneously, SB 45 and SB 125. Madam Counsel, if you'd summarize briefly SB 45, which probably will not move because it's near identical of SB 125, focus on SB 125, and at the same time, I would ask that Mr. Barton and Mr. Holliday come forward.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 45 and Senate Bill 125 are nearly identical. There are two statutes which require notice in advance. One is a general notice of a right to a hearing. That's at ORS 183-415. And then the second notice to parties before hearing of rights and procedure. That's ORS 183-413. Senate Bill 45 requires an addition, directs the agencies, rather, to include an active service member's federal right to stay proceedings under the Service Members Civil Relief Act with the notice to parties before hearing of rights and procedure only. The difference between that and Senate Bill 125 is that it inserts that requirement to include the service member's federal right to stay proceedings under both of those the statutory citations. There is a subsequent referral on both of these measures to judiciary.
Thank you. Mr. Barton, if you would, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Jesse Barton. I'm an attorney in private practice here in Salem. I'm also an adjunct criminal justice instructor at Western Oregon University. I've been a member of the Bar's Military Assistance Panels for 10 years and is a member of the Bar's Executive Committee of its Military and Veteran Law Section. Before I wanted, I spoke about Senate Bill 125. Mr. Chairman, just briefly, I could mention that our executive committee chairman, Chris Kent, intended to be here today. He's unable to be here due to a death in the family, but he has submitted written testimony which outlines the bar's various programs, numerous programs, in assisting service members, veterans, and their families. So I believe the committee already has that written testimony. So that I wanted to, with respect to Senate Bill 125, what that bill would do is it would ensure that administrative agencies that conduct contested case hearings follow the procedures that are established by the Federal Service Member Civil Relief Act in the same manner that the State Judicial Department already does. Actually, what happens in civil proceedings, which is all that the Service Members Civil Relief Act or the SCRA applies to, various mechanisms are in place to ensure that when a service member is called on to active duty, the service member can have the civil proceeding, which would include an administrative proceeding, stayed or put on hold during active duty service to ensure that when the service member is on active duty, they don't have to worry about such things as default judgments because they're unable to make appearances while they're on active duty and wherever they may be. And I want to clarify something, and that is that it is possible for a service member on active duty to not be able to have a stay, or for the stay to be the stay of the proceedings to be lifted while the service member is on active duty, if it's possible for the service member to participate in the civil proceeding. For example, if a service member is called into active duty and is at Joint Base Lewis-McChord up near Tacoma, that service member might be able to participate in the judicial or administrative proceeding. So wouldn't be necessarily be able to have the stay, but if the person's military service prevents them from being able to participate in the proceeding, then they can have a stay. Default judgments cannot be entered against the service member without the agency or the court going through specific procedures that the SCRA outlines, which has established, which I've outlined in my materials. And that really is the long and the short of what the bill does. It would actually amend two provisions in the Administrative Procedure Act. One amendment would require that a compliance with the SCRA's notification requirements to establish that persons who are eligible to have contested case hearings are notified by the agency of their SCRA rights. And then there would be situations where a person already is involved in a contested case hearing, gets called on to active duty, and in that kind of situation, the agency would be required to notify the service member of his or her SCRA rights. But the real point there is that the notification isn't going to go only to service members. The notification would go to all persons who are eligible to have contested case hearings or who have contested case hearings going already. That would ensure that with that kind of blanket notification, service members will be notified of their SCRA rights in these administrative proceedings. And just as a quick aside, I know that there are some concerns among the agencies and their ability to comply with these new notification requirements. I don't know. I do know that the Judicial Department brought itself voluntarily into 4 or 5 years ago, the Judicial Department learned that the state court system was out of compliance with the SCRA, and the court system voluntarily brought itself into compliance with the SCRA several years ago. And so the court system, they had to comply with a new proceeding which the legislature established by passing House Bill 2702 in 2011, which allows service members called on to active duty to stay DUI diversion programs while on active duty. That forced the Judicial Department to change forms regarding DUI diversion programs, and the Judicial Department changed those forms within 5 weeks of the effective date of the bill. So I feel confident that state agencies will be able to comply with the new notification requirements. It may take some time to ramp up, but it should be done. There's one point I wanted to make, and we just learned a couple of weeks ago in a bar executive committee meeting that there are like five military deployments scheduled for the 41st Brigade over the next year and a half.
That's correct.
And it would be useful, I think, because of that, for this bill, if it would pass with an emergency clause, to ensure that service members who are deployed before what would be January 1st, 2014, receive the benefit of this legislation if, in fact, the legislation passes. So I ask the committee to consider adding an emergency clause to the bill if that could be done. I'd be happy to assist in any drafting of that emergency clause as needed. That is my testimony, Mr. Chairman. In case the
Mr. Holliday?
Thank you, Chair Boquist, Madam Vice Chair Mona Sanderson. And my apologies to Senator Olson. I neglected to include your name on my salutation. I'm also on the executive committee with Mr. Barton here for the Veterans and Military Affairs of the Oregon State Bar. However, I'm testifying in my individual capacity today. You have the written testimony before you that I intend to submit. There are two other points I'd like to add to that. First, when I've been up at Fort Lewis on legal assistance and my reserve status, I think twice in the last 4 or 5 years, when there's been an upcoming major deployment, I have had both prosecutors, defense attorneys, and service members, I suppose that'd be three types, call me and say, so-and-so is being deployed, they have a court hearing, what can we do? And I've been able to advise them of their rights under the Service Member Civil Relief Act, and either arrange, well, usually we've arranged a hearing after the redeployment. This bill provides that without a call being made to the local JAG office, and it prevents the rehearing or retrying of cases and a waste of resources. I believe that if Senate Bill 125 or 124 and 125 are adopted, you will save time and money far more than what the hue and cry against the bill will bring. The statistics I cite in my letter are from the backside. And we're dealing, in that case, in Clackamas County, where I live, with people who have been subjected to the process who didn't know what their rights were necessarily. Now, that number is not a complete number, however, because these are people who are self-identified as vets. They're not active duty service members. And I want to stress this. This is the 10% that's reported is only since January 1. The new sheriff, Craig Roberts, is taking an attitude that he is there to help veterans, both in employment and when his deputies pull them over on the road. So although we have a new outlook for the treatment of veterans in Clackamas County, it's scary, even in 1 month, what the data is already revealing. I would urge the committee to pass the bill out, and I would urge the committee to talk to their fellow senators to urge passage on the Senate floor. Thank you.
Thank you. Madam Vice Chair, questions?
Yes. So I was up for re-election this last cycle, and one of the people I visited, he was out working on his car, was a veteran who had served in Iraq for a couple of years, and he was wanted. He committed a crime. He didn't rob. He didn't kill. But he fled. He fled to California for about 18 months. He was telling me his story. And he says, and he came back, though, because he knew, I mean, who knows if it was post-traumatic stress or what. But he did come back. And he says he wished that there was someone he could just talk to about it. So is this type of legislation help someone like that?
No, Madam Vice Chair. It helps those who are on active duty from losing administrative rights or other rights while they're deployed, and therefore from having to have a rehearing once they get back.
Okay.
The ongoing need to address veterans' issues will require different legislation. And as Mr. Barton alluded to, there'll be a number of returning veterans, and so it'd be also good to get ahead of that snowball. But that is for a different legislation on a different day.
Thank you.
Let me follow up on Madam Vice Chair. Jesse, if you'd make a unbiased pitch, the Bar Association does, the Oregon State Bar does have a veterans referral service. That's you want to make a pitch for that here?
That's right, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, one of the things that the Bar does have and has had for 10 years is called the Military Assistance Panel. That'll be discussed in Chairman Kent's written testimony, but it's like we have 100 and some lawyers providing free pro bono legal services for service members. I think he mentions we've handled like 800 cases on that basis. I know Mark and I have handled several between the two of us. So possibly that service member could have contacted the Bar's Military Assistance Panel and gotten a referral to a panel lawyer who might have been able to provide him the kind of legal assistance he needs, at least get him started down the right path and getting him the legal assistance he would need.
So just to follow up, I know this isn't the bill, sorry, but so on the website, if they Googled military services in Oregon, they would get a number or something
that's
that they
right.
could call?
That's right. Mr. Chairman, that's absolutely correct. There'll just be something on there, say, information for the public. It says at the top, in the banner portion of the Bar's website, click on that, drops down a bunch of information. It'll say military assistance. Click on that, and it sends you into a page that will explain how to get assistance through the military assistance. But it works really well.
He was technically savvy, and I wish I had had that information.
Right. And I think you can either, the easiest way to approach is either Oregon State Bar Military Assistance or Veterans Legal Assistance Oregon. In either case, generally in the first page of Yahoo or Google, it comes up with the State Bar's webpage that's there. Senator Olson, questions?
No.
Senator Courtney, questions?
No.
Thank you, gentlemen. Don't go anywhere because we're going to move to another bill here momentarily. One of the things that I just want to put on the record so we have it, the SCRA is one of those issues in which, like ESGR, which is another acronym out there, which is Employer Support the Guard, we have our primary problems even a decade after deployment with government agencies, which is why this is before us and why it's going to judiciary very shortly. I appreciate the work the bar has done on this. Because this is a priority issue, it is going to be the chair's intent. It's scheduled for a work session next week. I'd like to have SB 125 amended, bring an amendment to the committee for an emergency clause for proposal. And given the fact that no agency is signed up, which is raises my eyebrow right off the bat, and this is a known problem, SB 45 will be kept in committee, and if necessary, we'll take up SB 45 if the other bill bogs down someplace else. And with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on SB 45 and 125 and open a public hearing on SB 124. Nikki, if you'd come down and join these gentlemen down here, because I think you're signed up for testimony for this, and Counselor, if you'd be kind enough to...
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, Senate Bill 124 requires courts to consider defendant's service member status at sentencing, declares an emergency, and is effective on passage. This also has a subsequent referral to judiciary.
Committee members and members of the public, this bill has been around since the 2005 session, and virtually every time that it's come up, something has derailed the train. Under the leadership of Bill Taylor and the State Bar Association, there's been a host of interim meetings on this particular issue, which is why this does have a subsequent referral to judiciary, and hopefully, I don't know, fourth or fifth time is a charm here. With that, I'm going to defer, because I see that the young lady checked neutral, and I'm going to defer to Mr. Barton to lead first, because he is the proponent from the Bar Association, and then we'll move to ladies, and then we'll go on to Mr. Holliday. So, Jesse, if you'd...
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, again, Jesse Barton with the State Bar's Executive Committee, the Military... or Veterans of Military Affairs section. Yeah, that's correct. This bill actually started as a House bill a few years ago. Part of it actually did pass 2 years ago, Senate Bill 999. The original bill that we had a few years ago had two provisions in it, essentially, one which would enhance district attorney authority to divert from prosecution cases involving service members. Service members, by the way, is defined broadly, not just as people currently in the service, but also as veterans. And there are certain qualification standards for that regarding type of military discharge the person must have had if they were going to qualify as a service member, as that term's defined. So that the diversion piece passed in 2010, a Senate Bill 999. The part that didn't pass was the judicial mitigation factor piece that was part of the original House bill. And here it is now. And really what it is, it's a Senate Bill 124. What it actually does is simply crystallizes or clarifies a fact that military service can be, isn't necessarily, but it can be treated as a mitigating factor in sentencing. For it to be treated as a mitigating factor in sentencing, particularly in a felony case, the service member and actually his defense attorney will need to show that the service member status substantially and compellingly justifies some form of mitigation, which usually you expect that to take the form of probation instead of prison. So Senate Bill 124 would clarify and crystallize the fact that service member status can serve as a mitigating factor. That's just one piece of the puzzle. The thought that we have, and you know, by trade, I'm a criminal defense attorney. That's what I've done for the last 25 years. And that's really kind of keys my interest in this whole concept. But the first line of defense in these kind of cases where a service member gets caught up in the criminal justice system, the first line of defense really does need to be the criminal defense attorney. So this bill would certainly alert a criminal defense attorney to the possibility of using service member status as a mitigating factor. And then in addition to that, there are other services available to criminal defense lawyers in the representation of the service member clients. The state bar has done a tremendous amount of work in terms of providing resources on its website and providing training on how to handle service member defendant cases for state bar members, as has the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. So between those resources and the mitigating factor that would be created by Senate Bill 124, I think that would put criminal defense lawyers in a good position to provide that first line of defense when it's appropriate. Again, I want to reiterate, not every service member that comes and faces criminal prosecution is going to be entitled to mitigation. It doesn't work like that. The attorney for that service member needs to establish this substantial and compelling justification for using the mitigating factor. And that could be difficult to do, but that's the burden that falls on the criminal defense lawyer who represents the service member. So with that, I'm going to close my remarks and ask the committee to approve Senate Bill 124.
Madam.
Thank you, Chair Boquist, members of the committee. Nikki Terziev here on behalf of the Oregon Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence. We are the 50-plus nonprofits across the state that operate in communities, locally based, providing services, medical planning, legal advocacy, safety planning for victims, helping them to become survivors of their domestic or sexual violence. We just want to take this opportunity really to thank you all. We had some great conversations in the interim, and Jess and Mr. Kent actually took some time out and really came and sat down with us and some of the voices of the survivors and victims of crime, and train firmly on the tracks, sir. We're not trying to derail anything. We're mostly just interested in keeping the lines of communication open, and we do want to also thank the bar. They were very gracious in their offer to help coordinate treatment options and services and programs that they might be able to advertise to help give a select list that judges and attorneys can point to for their clients to seek the proper treatment. And that's really what we're looking for, so we can help interact and impact in the right place with the right message and the right tools. And that's it.
Thank you, Madam. Mr. Holliday.
Thank you. This bill, like Senate Bill 125, helps prevent a problem, and that it's not a get-out-of-jail-free card, but it will alert the bench and the bar to the possibility of mitigating factors that arise from a service member's status. To the extent that we can possibly identify that, bring it in for later treatment, or bring the service member in for treatment, et cetera, you'll avoid the problem that my contact at Clackamas County is finding out that they're convicted, showing up at the probation office, and, oh, by the way, we need to plug them into a system. Now what do we do? It'd be nice to have the horse before the cart, so that, as the vice chair observed, this, whereas maybe Senate Bill 125 is not directed toward vets, this one is. Thank you.
Thank you. And I do want to thank, again, Mr. Taylor, before we go to any other questions here, because Mr. Taylor and the Bar Association worked together, the victims groups worked together, district attorney, sheriffs. I don't think at any given time there was a seat in the room, and there were more people in that work group than there were sitting in this hearing. So everybody's, been on board, and it's been all-inclusive across the board. This does have a subsequent referral to judiciary because they did the work, but the agreement was is we would make sure that we have a veteran stamp on it and then send it over to judiciary. Madam Vice Chair, question? Senator Courtney? No. Questions? Senator Olson?
No.
It's the chair's intent that SB 124 is scheduled for a work session next week. It's the intent to come up for a vote, and if it's the committee's choice, then to move it on to judiciary. If there's any member of the public that has either pro or con that would like to submit testimony to be considered during that work session, please get it to the committee administrator, and again, or myself, or any of the committee members. Again, I remind everybody, we have a new system online, OLIS, Oregon Legislative Information System, in which you can track what is going on with the committee. Senator Courtney, you have a question.
Counsel, give me an example of how this would work. Pick a client, pick an indictment, just take me through it.
I would use as an example, Mr. Chairman, Senator Courtney, I would use as an example a case that arose out of Yamhill County.
Okay.
This is a tough case. This gentleman, a veteran, not long back from Iraq, where he served a tour of duty as an infantryman. He also had been trained in armor as a tank crewman. Was in McMinnville with two women, two men, walking down the street. A large, drunk, belligerent man approached them, tried to pick a fight. Now, he's just back from Iraq. He's still in the National Guard, so he undergoes training all the time. He's going to be deployed to Iraq again. He's a soldier. He responded in that situation as a soldier. He responded in defense of himself, in defense of his buddies. But he responded in a way that is not really acceptable for the civilian world. He hadn't readjusted to the civilian world in time, and he really can't readjust to the civilian world because he's going back to Iraq very soon. So his circumstance was one that would call out for, in my opinion, would call out for some sort of mitigation in his sentence. He actually used a pocket knife. He carries a pocket knife. It wasn't a big, nasty knife. It was just a pocket knife. And he used that to ward off this really big guy, this drunk, belligerent guy, from attacking him and his friends. He acted as a soldier, but he acted as a soldier in the civilian world. That calls out for mitigation and sentencing. The young man is facing a prison sentence. His case is now before the Supreme Court. The unfortunate thing in his particular case was that his case was prosecuted well before all these resources that are available now to criminal defense attorneys. Those resources weren't available back then. It was several years ago when the prosecution was done, back in 2007. The information that we have today, or that's available to criminal defense lawyers today, just wasn't available back then. His lawyer actually did, given what she knew and what was known at the time by the criminal defense community, she did a pretty good job, but it wasn't a good enough job to obtain an acquittal. But when I look at that case, and I see that as a case, I always think of that case as the example I always want to consider as one where a mitigating factor would have been perfect for the situation. It wouldn't have involved post-traumatic stress disorder or traumatic brain injury, because that wasn't what was, somehow prompting his response to the situation. What prompted his response to the situation was his training and experience as a combat soldier. And that's something that we're just going to be dealing with in this state for some period of time, as these young men and women return from these combat assignments and have to readjust to civilian life. It takes time, and there can be these occurrences during that adjustment period.
Thank you, counsel. So the issue is mitigation of sentence, not the defense.
Correct. It could be. That's a good point. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Senator Courtney. That's a good point. There would have been a defense that could have been put on, a sort of a self-defense claim, which failed. But at sentencing, the same kind of defense can be presented at sentencing to try to... I'm glad you brought that point up. The same kind of defense information, or the same sort of information, or the same sort of set of facts that could have been used as a defense, which may have failed as a defense, could succeed as a mitigating factor, could be used to succeed as a mitigating factor. So the person still gets convicted, and they still get sentenced, but maybe the sentence is probation instead of prison, that sort of thing.
Okay, so I don't mean to act like a lawyer.
You are a lawyer. You don't have to act like a lawyer.
Yeah, but I'm trying not to do that. So, counsel, thank you very much. So you could right now use the fact that this individual is a service person to try to get an acquittal, to explain the actions of. That's already there. You're saying you don't need necessarily, but where legislation you need is, okay, you don't get the acquittal, there is a conviction, so then you go to the judge at sentencing time, and that's specifically where this bill is going. Is that right, counsel? Is that what you're
saying? That is exactly right. Mr. Chairman, right. Senator Courtney, the defense or the facts would have been used to assert a self-defense and a defense of third persons type of defense. That's clear. That's in the criminal code. It's been there since 1971. But it's not expressly clear in the criminal code or anywhere else that military service can serve as a mitigating factor. And that's the essence for the need for Senate Bill 124.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you, Chair. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, sir. And to go through, let me go back to the work group again. Because of the murkiness of legal world, the work group did include people from the courts and everything else, and everybody kind of came to the conclusion that there's no clear statute right now that allows this, which is why we're where we're at now. So is there anyone else any other comments or questions? Is there anyone else that wants to testify? If not, again, it's the intent to bring this to a work session to move to judiciary on SB 124 next week at the same time. And with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on SB 124. And we have one item left that is on the docket. Colleagues, I'm going to open a work session for the purpose of measure introduction, and what we have is another placeholder bill that we would like to put up. And again, as I point out, even though it is a placeholder bill,
a motion for or against on any of these LCs becoming committee bills is not a yes or no vote in the future, and the merits of anything would be discussed later on in the future. Madam Counsel?
You want to talk about the placeholder bill?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the placeholder LC 3152, everybody got a hard copy at the dais today, and it was also posted on the new information system. It's a, as the Mr. Chair has described, a placeholder. It's a duplicate of Senate Bill 33, which is pending in this committee already, with a different relating to clause.
Chair Boquist, I move that the following legislative concept be introduced as a committee bill. We are in working session.
Yes, we're in working session.
Okay. LC 3152, dated January 30th, 2013. I don't know if there's a time on that or not.
Okay. Madam Vice Chair moves that LC 3152 be introduced, dated January 30th, 2013, be introduced as a committee bill. Is there discussion, Madam Vice Chair?
No.
Senator Courtney?
No.
Senator Olson, do we need a vote?
Or no objections?
Are there any objections?
No objections.
Seeing no objections, then LC 3152 will be introduced as a committee bill. Madam Vice Chair, other items for the committee?
No, just a vote in favor of this legislative concept is not a vote on the merits of the concept itself, and it's not indicative of a member's opinion or position, if any, on the content and the measure.
Thank you, Madam Vice Chair. If there's nothing else, then we're going to close the work session that was for measure introduction. If there's no more things between or before the committee, again, for members of the public, I advise you on the OLIS system, there is a listing that shows the committee hearing dates. The committee agendas are all up posted for the next 8 weeks, and I believe most of the staff measure summaries are up there, even though my computer doesn't work.
Mr. Chair, members, there are still some access issues. I'm not sure if folks can see the preliminaries, okay. But I can check on that.
All right. And with that, same time, same place, next week, Thursday, 1 p.m.
Mr. Chair, good meeting. Good to go. Hope you understand what I'm trying to get out of your heart in town.